The chuppah embodies integration without assimilation for a couple covenanting together. And America, as we have said, was founded on the notion of integration without assimilation, of a nation indivisible through covenant, but without one's religious identity subsumed into one another.
The Tikva Fund presents Jewish Ideas and the American Founders. Jewish Ideas and the American Founders is dedicated by Alan K. Schwartz in memory of his wife, Barbara R. Schwartz, and in tribute to all Jewish Americans, both strangers and neighbors, and is supported by the Zahava and Moshe L. Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought at Yeshiva University.
Rabbi Soloveitchik, this journey from the arrival of Jonas Phillips in South Carolina to now, the last lecture that we're about to see, has been a breathtaking, incredible story of the Jewish meaning of America. What are we going to see in this last lecture that ties everything together?
We will be using one extraordinary Jewish symbol that so struck and fascinated Benjamin Rush. And that is the chuppah, the wedding canopy, which everyone knows today is a central feature of Jewish weddings, but few understand its significance and the various interpretations that have been given of it. And what we'll show here is that actually the different themes of a chuppah, different ideas that it represent, speak profoundly, of course, first and foremost to what Jews believe, but it also speaks profoundly to America, to the message of the Declaration, and to the story of the Phillips family, who end up saving Monticello and preserving the legacy of the author of the Declaration. So it is actually in the chuppah and the wedding attended by Benjamin Rush, the chuppah in general as a symbol, and the chuppah specifically that was attended by Benjamin Rush, that all of the different threads of our previous lectures will come together. Let us briefly summarize what we have seen thus far. We began by studying the story of Jonas Phillips, whose own life embodied the extraordinary nature of religious liberty in America, and what it means to seek the right to be both ger and toshav, both stranger and neighbor in society. We then ponder the impact of the Bible on the American idea and its self-understanding, reflecting on Franklin and Jefferson's suggested seals for the United States, and the remarkable and unusual transmission of one rabbinic approach to monarchy via Thomas Paine to the American public. We then return to Jonas Phillips, to the wedding of his daughter, attended by Benjamin Rush, and considered how the concepts of covenant and contract are reflected in America's own founding documents, the Declaration and the Constitution. We then learned how America received, debated, dedicated, and gave thanks for this Constitution, and how America's Jews were received, blessed, and embraced by the first president elected under that Constitution, George Washington. Having discussed how Washington's successors, Adams and Jefferson, respectively viewed the heritage of the Jews, we now seek to draw our disparate threads together in returning to the Phillips family and to the wedding attended by Benjamin Rush. And we'll be focusing on one sentence in particular. Benjamin Rush writes as follows after he describes the mincha ceremony with much Jewish talking that took place before. The ceremony was followed by the erection of a beautiful canopy composed of white and red silk in the middle of the floor. It was supported by four young men by means of four poles who put on white gloves for the purpose. As soon as this canopy was fixed, the bride, accompanied with her mother, sister, and a long train of female relations, came downstairs. She was handsome at all times, but the occasion and her dress rendered her in a peculiar manner a most lovely and affecting object. Innocence, modesty, fear, respect, and devotion appeared all at once in her countenance. He then goes on to describe the pouring of the wine, the drinking of the wine from the glass by both bride and groom, the breaking of the glass, and the groom saluting his bride, and joy and congratulations being spread throughout the room. Now we reach the sentence that is the focus of our discussion. Rush writes, I asked the meaning, after the ceremony was over, of the canopy and of the drinking of the wine and the breaking of the glass. So, what would you say if you received these questions? What is the significance of these rituals? Let us go in reverse order. The breaking of the glass, he was told, at the conclusion of the business, was designed to teach the bride and groom the brittleness and uncertainty of human life and the certainty of death, and thereby to temper and moderate their present joys. It's not bad. That's actually pretty good. Their mutually partaking of the same glass of wine was intended to denote the mutuality of their goods. Okay. I never heard that before, but I could use that in the Dvar Torah. That sounds right. Then the following. I was told by one of the company that in Europe they generally marry in the open air, and that the canopy was introduced to defend the bride and groom from the action of the sun and from rain. Not exactly. Now, the truth is, it's actually quite stunning that this is what was said to him. If any of you were asked at a Jewish wedding, if somebody came over to you at a wedding at the Waldorf and said, hello, I'm Benjamin Rush, and I'm interested in knowing what is going on with this canopy, you would have said quite simply that this represents the home of the bride and groom. And it's striking that this is not what was said to Rush at this wedding. The explanation itself is, of course, odd, because if it's introduced to protect them from the sun and rain, why are they setting it up inside a house when they're getting married indoors? It's like those people who sometimes wear a coat. There are Jews who have that tradition of wearing a coat at their wedding, because people used to get married outside. But if that's the entire reason why we have this chuppah, one of the supreme symbols of the Jewish wedding today, that would be a little odd. And the fact that they gave this answer then actually shows us something significant. And we only find this answer surprising because we are seeing it anachronistically. This answer reflects the fact that the canopy at Jewish weddings in 1787, as an institution, was relatively new, perhaps a couple hundred years at the most in Jewish history. And it certainly had yet at the time to become a universal practice among Sephardic Jewry. It had begun in Ashkenazic Jewry and then spread from there. The truth is that of those liturgies and rituals that are taken as the supreme symbol of Judaism, such as Kol Nidre, the canopy of the chuppah, or the mourner's kaddish, none of these existed in Talmudic times. Talmud has kaddish, but not for mourners. Talmud has a word called chuppah at weddings, but that is not a canopy. If you had brought Rava or Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi or Rabbi Akiva to a wedding at Jonas Phillips' home or at the Waldorf, he would have asked, like Benjamin Rush, what is the meaning of this canopy? Because chuppah in the Talmud refers not to a canopy, but to the home that the groom would build for the wife. The way a wedding would work in rabbinic Judaism, in ancient and classical times, is that it was actually two parts. If you saw a woman you wanted to marry, you would perform the kiddushin, now the giving of the ring, in those days the giving of pretty much anything, in front of two witnesses. That did not make you married. That just ensured she couldn't marry anybody else in the meantime. And then you would spend the next year building a home for your wife. The Sheva Brachot, the seven blessings of Nisuin, forming them as husband and wife, would be recited. And then there would be a festive meal, and then they would retire to their marital home, which was called the chuppah. That is the simple understanding of what the Talmud means by chuppah. Talmud makes no mention of a canopy. During medieval times, the chuppah, what was used to symbolize the home of the bride and groom, referred to various objects. But it's only in the 16th century, in the writings of Rama, the Ashkenazic rabbi in the Shulchan Aruch, that we first find mention in legal codes of a canopy on poles to reflect and to symbolize the home of a Jewish bride and a Jewish groom. It's only then that it first began. And the evolution, actually, of the chuppah as we know it today, a canopy, is shrouded in mystery. But I believe that in studying the various explanations for it, we will be able to understand why it was so profoundly and poetically fitting, and perhaps providential, that this founder, Benjamin Rush, who gave the book Common Sense its name, and who reconciled Adams and Jefferson, and who signed the Declaration of Independence and participated in the Constitutional Convention, and who embraced and celebrated the religious liberties afforded by the Constitution, was present at a chuppah, and most especially was present at this chuppah, at this moment in history. And so we will study several interpretations of the chuppah, what it means for us as Jews, and how that deepens our understanding of the Jewish meaning of America. So we begin with the first explanation. And this explanation, suggested by scholars, academic scholars of Minhag, of the evolutions of Jewish tradition, actually indicates that when the wedding guests told Rush that it was linked to protecting the bride and groom from the sun and the rain, that wasn't all there is to it, but that was part of it. You see, there are those who suggest that seeing as how Jews no longer got married over a year-long process, and they were no longer building homes for their wives, the ritual needed something to symbolize the home of the bride and groom. And if the canopy ultimately evolved as the symbol of this home, it was because it was actually taken from a Gentile Christian ritual, and that is from the royal or coronation canopy. Because throughout Europe, in a royal procession, the monarch or the pope would be given a canopy to both signify his or her significance, elevation and separation from the rest of the parade, and of course to offer protection to him or her from the elements. And what was done in a bridal procession and a groom's procession in Jewish weddings, which did take place outside, is that to signify the significance of the bride and the groom, a canopy would be placed over them to show them honor, and then ultimately to symbolize, in the evolution of the tradition, to symbolize the home that they were forming together. And so they took this royal ceremony, the coronation canopy, and placed it over the head of Jewish bride and groom, any Jewish bride and groom. And this indeed is a reflection of the commonly quoted rabbinic concept, whose origin lies in the Pirkei d'Rabbi Eliezer, that chatan domeh lemelech, that a groom is akin to a king, that every Jewish bride and groom is a royal couple. They are all majestic, and they are all deserving of this royal canopy. And if Jews take a royal accoutrement and apply it to two humble Jews, to a bride and groom in the ghetto in Europe, this tells us that Jewish tradition is audaciously asserting that the common conception of kingship and of majesty and of royalty is very different from the Jewish one. This is something that we must understand. I am uniquely suited to show how this is different because as an Anglophile, I have done a series of studies of royal coronation ceremonies. And I have read and watched plays and films that relate to the very essence and meaning of majesty, such as Beckett, Henry V, the King's Speech, the King and I, and the Lion King. I have seen many, many films relating to majesty. So here we reflect on what the chuppah tells us about the difference between the Jewish approach to royalty and the common one. For over 1,000 years, the crowning of an English king or queen has featured a reference to the anointing of King Solomon. Thus, in 1953, the Archbishop of Canterbury said, as he anointed Elizabeth II, "As Solomon was anointed by Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet, so be thou anointed, blessed, and consecrated queen over the peoples, whom the Lord thy God has given thee to govern." Handel, for George II, composed a coronation hymn whose words cite scripture. Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet anointed Solomon king, And all the people rejoiced and said, "Long live the king." And we can understand why this verse was chosen. The anointing of King Solomon in the Bible featured magnificent crowds, priests and prophets proclaiming, crowds cheering, "Yechi HaMelech Shlomo Liolam," may King Solomon live forever. And the underlying assumption here seems to be that it is the pomp and circumstance, it is the gold and the silver and the silk that creates a coronation, the trumpets and the cheers. That is what makes a monarch. As one civilian soldier remarks in Henry V, "What have kings that privates have not too? Save ceremony, save general ceremony." And yet the Tanakh has always seen the anointing, not of Solomon but of his father, as more significant. The prophet Samuel had been sent to Bethlehem to crown a new king, and he sought someone like Saul, tall, masculine, with the makings of a mighty warrior, someone who looked physically impressive, who looked majestic and mighty. And then God responds to Samuel with my favorite verse in the Bible. You know, in America, when people run for president, one of the questions they ask is, "What is your favorite Bible verse?" So, I'm ready. This is my favorite Bible verse. God says, "Al tabet el mareu ki ma'astiv." Look not to his appearance. Do not seek the superficial. I reject this. Ki ma'astiv. Ha'adam yireh la'inayim, v'Hashem yireh la'levav. Man looks merely to what he sees, but God looks to the heart. So what this means is that royalty is more than what people make of it. It is a matter of the heart, and in the expansion of the heart of the king to include the needs, physical and spiritual, of the people. And perhaps one of the most important statements on Jewish monarchy and Jewish law, Rambam Maimonides writes that if the Torah cares so much about the spiritual formation of the monarch, if al hasarat libo hikpida Torah, if the Torah was so concerned about the religious devotion in the heart of the king, it is because, writes Rambam, shelibo hu lev kol kahal Yisrael, because the king's heart is the heart of the entire Jewish people. It is expanding one's heart. It is living for more than oneself. That is, for Judaism, the essence of royalty. The wonderful film The King's Speech features the King of England's relationship with his speech therapist, Lionel Logue. In order that they be equals during therapy, Logue insists that he calls the king Bertie. But of course, they are not equals, and the king treats him the entire time like a servant. Never calls him Lionel, always calls him Logue. At the end of the film, when the king, thanks to Logue's help, successfully gives his wartime speech, he first says, "Thank you, Logue." But then the king walks over, shakes Logue's hand, and says, "Thank you, my friend." And only then does Logue respond, "Thank you, Your Majesty." And the point seems to be that Logue understood that it was precisely the king expanding his circle of friends beyond what he needed to. That is actually what made him majestic. Living for others, that is majesty. And this is the meaning behind the commonly quoted concept that a groom in Judaism is akin to a king. The biography We Two, which is a description of the marriage of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, describes how once Queen Victoria got into an argument with her husband, and he locked himself in anger in the bedroom. And she knocked on the door, and he said, "Who's there?" And she said, "The Queen of England." No one answered. Again a knock. "Who's there?" "It's your wife, Albert." And then the door opened. The truth is that we Jews may not have married king and queens, but for Judaism it is the choice to marry, the choice to enter into covenant with another. That is what is royal. That is what makes you king and queen. Because it is expanding life beyond oneself that defines the melech, the king. It is pledging at a wedding to live their lives for someone other than themselves. That is majestic. And if that is what is royal, expanding beyond oneself, that is because that is precisely the nature of the Almighty's royalty. As we say every week, Adon Olam Asher Malach B'Terem Kol Yitzir Nivra, Master of the Universe who reigned before creation, La'et Nasa B'Cheftzo Kol, when all at his will came into being, Azai Melech Shemo Nikra, then and only then could God be called king. God only became king because he made room in his divine life for others. In contrast to the customary coronation of kings, in which first a people exists, then crown a monarch, God became king by allowing his people, humanity, to come into existence. What made the Almighty a monarch is that though utterly self-sufficient, he was not satisfied to live in existence all alone, and that he brings a world into being and covenants with them, that's the Brit of Noach, and then covenants with a particular people. In Jewish mysticism, this is described as a great mystery. God, though infinite and everywhere, lovingly still made room for the universe to come into existence and thereby became a king. And thus the transference of the coronation canopy from royalty to covenanting bride and groom is a provocative and, seen rightfully, a small-d democratic idea. It indicates that people tend to misinterpret what is truly majestic and misunderstand what royalty is and need to recognize that only God is truly king, and it is imitation of his divine life that we are royal. There's a wonderful story about how in 1966, Shmuel Yosef Agnon became the first Israeli to be awarded the Nobel Prize. And he was informed that on December 10th, in the Royal Palace of Stockholm, he would receive the prize from the hands of His Majesty, King Gustav of Sweden. Agnon in turn informed His Majesty that he would have to be late because December 10th fell out on Shabbat. So the king sent a stretch limo on Shabbat afternoon, idling impatiently. It wasn't so bad because, you know, Shabbat in December in Sweden ends at like 2 o'clock. Though the ceremony had started already, Agnon takes his time. He waits till Shabbat is over. He davens Ma'ariv. He says Havdalah, marking the end of Shabbat. Only then does he get dressed for the ceremony. The chauffeur is champing at the bit. He's desperate to go. He has been ordered by a king to get to the palace as soon as possible. But Agnon could not leave yet, because you see, it was also Hanukkah. And so he had to light 4 candles, pausing to ponder the miraculous existence throughout the age of the people that he would be representing that evening and the divine source of that people's endurance. Finally, his limousine rushed him across Stockholm with a siren-wailing motorcycle escort. The stretch limo, the regal car of the king, proved useless, as Agnon had to sit in the front with the driver so he could plug in his shaver into the cigarette lighter to eliminate the beard that he had grown over Shabbat. Finally, he arrived just in time to receive the prize for literature. One is supposed to accept the prize silently and then walk back from the royal presence. I'm quoting a description of this. And so reporters were shocked to see his lips moving as he stood before the king. And they asked him afterwards, "What did you say to the king?" And Agnon responded, "I wasn't speaking to the king. I was addressing the King of Kings, saying the blessing according to the Talmud that you're supposed to see when you see Gentile royalty, a blessing he had never said before, but had been eager to say. Blessed art thou, King of the universe, Asher Natan Mikvodola Basar Vadam, who chooses to bestow majesty on flesh and blood." In fact, if you go back to the Times and look up the interview with him, when it was first announced that he received the prize, first Israeli ever, and they say to him, "What are you thinking?" This is the Times, I think. "What are you thinking about? You've just been, awarded the Nobel Prize." He says, "Yeah, it's very exciting because there's this blessing in the Talmud, you say, when you see kings. And I've always wanted to say that blessing." That's literally what Agnon says. He just received the Nobel Prize. This is what he's excited about. But he's excited about it because there's actually a profound political point here. There's something subversive about this blessing. "Blessed are you, the true king, who gives majesty to mere flesh and blood." It's a statement that for all the ceremony and for all the genuflecting before these kings are not truly kings. These are Melech Evyons, as we discussed the Piyut. This is not the Melech Elyon. This is not the heavenly king. At the heart of this blessing, as Agnon's story indicates, is a rabbinic reminder that these are not truly kings. And as we discussed in our lecture about pain and common sense and the Talmudic precedence of it, it is precisely this worldview about the true nature of kingship that was adopted by America in the course of the revolution. It's recorded that whenever British monarchs get coronated, the crown that they use has jewels that match up to different monarchs from history. So the coronation crown has a sapphire of Edward the Confessor, pearls worn by Elizabeth I, a ruby that Henry V bore at Agincourt, and a diamond known as the Star of Africa. So this is a very heavy crown. And when George III was coronated, a large diamond fell off the crown and was temporarily lost. And the poets noted the ominous implication, and they thought that this was a prophecy that something bad would happen during the reign of George III. And the poets wrote, quote, "When first portentous it was known, great George had jostled from his crown the brightest diamond there. The omen mongers, one and all, foretold some mischief must befall, some loss beyond compare. And indeed, as they later said, it was under George III that Britain lost America, the crown jewel of the colonies. But it is more than that that was lost, or rather redefined. As we have seen, Thomas Paine imported one school of rabbinic thought into the American mind, a school of thought which warns against the allure of human majesty, of majesty based on crowns and jewels, and insists ideally on God as society's sole king, and of true royalty lying in imitation of and devotion to that king. And as we have also seen, it was Benjamin Rush who underwent that evolution in his own outlook, first visiting in reverence the House of Lords, sitting on the throne of George III, and saying that this throne was something to which this was the most anyone could actually aspire to. And then he came ultimately to understand that revering a throne of gold is an unbiblical approach, and that there is a better biblical approach to true majesty. And this audaciously small d democratic idea is at the heart of what the chuppah, the evolution of the chuppah, from Gentile kings to Jewish bride and groom. That is exactly what this canopy represents. It's therefore so fitting that Benjamin Rush himself became perhaps the first non-Jewish American to ever attend a chuppah, the man who embodied a new approach to royalty and who named the book Common Sense and imported this idea to the American public. His encounter with a canopy whose significance is not only spiritual, but political, poetically paralleled the declaration that he had signed, the transformation he had himself undergone, and the entire notion of majesty and equality that he had helped in America to bring about. That is the first interpretation of chuppah. This, however, is not all there is to the Jewish understanding of the marital canopy. And there is a popular interpretation today. This is the one that's written on almost all wedding handouts. This is a popular interpretation today, but one which is profound and also speaks directly to the legacy of Jonas Phillips and of religious liberty in his age and in ours. The chuppah, it is said, is the embodiment of the home that the Jewish husband and wife intend to build lovingly together in the future. And yet, facially, appears to be an odd sort of home to build because there are no walls. Is no boundary between public and private. It is open to the breezes on all four sides. But this, tradition has it, makes sense when the chuppah is perceived as an echo of the tent of Abraham and Sarah. Everybody's read their wedding handouts. Whose desert tent, according to the Talmud and tradition, had open doors on all four sides. And these open sides symbolized both Abraham's dedication to the larger world. After all, this is a man who runs out to serve three apparent pagans who appear out of nowhere at his door, but also his determination to bear his monotheistic message to the four corners of the earth. Vayikra b'shem Hashem, he called out in the name of God. Under the chuppah then, standing in the metaphorical shadow of Abraham and Sarah's tent, a Jewish husband and wife likewise commit themselves to the Abrahamic mission, to carrying their Judaism outside their home and into the world around them. Judaism, the new couple is affirming, guides and obligates them wherever they may go, or whatever they may do, or whatever they may be, or see, or become, whether in their own home or in the public square, unto the four corners of the earth. And what's striking about Rush's account is that he, a devout Christian, a founding father, is the one describing it. And it shows how welcome Jews felt, how relatively open they were about their faith, and about the ability to do what the chuppah represents. To bring their Jewishness out of their home and into the outside world. In the Enlightenment of Europe, that was not the way. The condition of acceptance, even post-emancipation, was to be, as was one version of a Jewish Enlightenment figure once wrote, I shall be a Jew in the tent, but a mensch, a human being, in the street, which echoes Shlomo Carlebach's famous statement that when he goes to college campuses, he says, if somebody comes to me and says, I'm a Catholic, I know that's a Catholic. If someone says to me, I know that's a Protestant, I know that's a Protestant. If someone comes to me and says, I'm just a human being, then I know that's a Jew. So, Jew in the home, a mensch, a human being in the street. But that is not a transformation. We can't leave our Judaism at home when we leave our home. As Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik has noted, the very same Bible that demands absolute devotion to the divine also obligates us to engage the world and demands both simultaneously. We don't cease to be religious when you enter the public square. On the one hand, he writes, the Bible commands man, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy soul and all thy might. On the other hand, he says, the same Bible which enjoined man to withdraw commands him also to return to the community which plants, harvests, regulates rivers, heals the sick, participates in state affairs, is imaginative in dreaming, daring in undertaking, and is out to conquer the world. The task of covenantal man, he says, is to be engaged in uniting the two, where man is both the creative, free agent and the obedient servant of God. The chuppah, the Abrahamic tent, open to the public, embodies a traditional Jew's belief that one cannot become a fundamentally different person upon crossing a threshold. One cannot check one's heritage at the door. The chuppah's message of fidelity to faith was embraced by Rush and his fellow patriots, who understood and enshrined in the Constitution the principle that true religious freedom means freedom to be loyal to your beliefs and customs, even when they are unpopular with the neighbors, and more importantly, even when you are engaging with those neighbors. Nobody embodied this belief more, and this American idea more, than the man escorting his daughter to the chuppah, Jonas Phillips, who wrote to the Constitution demanding that he be able to serve in the legislature not only as an American but as a Jew, and who said that I refuse to come to court on Shabbat because even if I'm subpoenaed, when I enter the court, I remain a Jew. So a Jewish wedding witnessed by a devoutly Christian American founder, a chuppah erected by Jonas Phillips' family and seen by Benjamin Rush, embodies the pluralistic promise of America. While the chuppah is a uniquely Jewish symbol, it also communicates an intrinsically American idea that our faith is an essential part of ourselves and cannot be amputated from our identity upon opening our front doors. And if traditional Jews and Christians understand this, and if America's founders understood this, it is not clear that everyone understands this today. And here I refer to a debate over religious liberty, which reared its head in 2012. It was then that the Obama administration's Department of Health and Human Services declared that Catholic and other faith-based institutions would be required to provide insurance policies, even if those providing that particular policy violates their own moral and religious principles, let's say in providing and facilitating abortifacient drugs, let's say. Failure to comply would result in a fine. Then the administration announced that they would be offering a compromise, that not the organizations, but rather the insurance companies that would be the ones paying for the prescriptions and procedures, as long as the institution, by signing forms, arranges for the insurance company to do so. Now, of course, this purport of accommodation was no accommodation at all. The religious organizations would still be obligated to provide employees with an insurance policy that facilitated acts violating the organization's religious tenets. And although religious leaders, such as leaders of the Catholic community in America, communicated this, the administration refused to change its position. But what was going unsaid at the time was a deeper scandal. And that is the following, that the administration, in instituting this policy, actually had a blanket exemption already for religious organizations. It just defined what is a religious organization in a very, very strict way. It said that only if you do not employ or serve members of other faiths are you considered a religious organization and entitled to religious liberty and exemption from this healthcare mandate. That was their original policy. Then the Department of Health and Human Services modified this slightly, exempting religious employers that are houses of worship, even if they employ members of other faiths, but did not exempt non-for-profit institutions such as Catholic University or your local Catholic hospital. If all you did is sit in a chapel and pray, then you would be a religious organization. But if you were to take an actual example, nuns who went out to serve the poor, whatever faith that poor may be, then they are not considered a religious organization and not entitled to the same religious freedom exemption. Now, I testified in Congress about this, not because I felt that Jewish organizations were dramatically impacted by this, but precisely because I felt it was important for Jews to speak out when they were not impacted. In refusing to extend religious liberty beyond the parameters of what the administration chooses to deem religious conduct, The administration denies people of faith the ability to define their religious activity. Therefore, not only does the new regulation threaten religious liberty in the narrow sense in requiring Catholic and other Christian communities to violate their religious tenets, also the administration impedes religious liberty by unilaterally redefining what it means to be religious. We were all sworn in, and I told them in advance that I wasn't going to swear, that I chose to affirm rather than swear for religious reasons. And you know, in the Constitution itself, this was clearly an issue for some Christian communities because they give the opportunity to affirm instead, even in the oath in the Constitution. And so then when we all stood up to swear, the chairman says, okay, I'm now going to ask you all to stand up and swear, and I see the counsel of the committee lean over and whisper something to the chairman of the committee. And he says, what? No, I'm sure everyone here will be willing to swear. It was us, it was clergy, so he meant they'd all be willing to swear. And I'm thinking, dude, we're here to talk about religious freedom. This is pretty ironic. And then later he says, you can watch, he says, let the record show that their swearing was swear or affirm. So it was retroactively redefined as affirming. And I said affirm, I did not say swear. Now, what I testified in my before this committee was that from the exemption that had been carved out by the Obama administration, two important corollaries follow. First, by carving out an exemption, no matter how narrow, the administration implicitly acknowledged that forcing employers to purchase these insurance policies may violate religious freedom. Second, the administration implicitly assumes that those who have left their homes and churches in order to engage society, let's say you're forming a Catholic university, but that faith motivates you to teach people who aren't Catholic, or you're forming a Catholic hospital, but that faith motivates you to also heal non-Catholics or non-Christians, that the administration says are no longer acting in a religious capacity, or to put it more bluntly, nuns who are going out to serve the poor are not entitled to the same exemption as nuns who pray, because their service is not considered, in the words of the administration guidelines, quote, the exclusively religious activities of any religious order. And this, as I said, betrays a complete misunderstanding of the very nature of religion. Because as Jews understand, religion and tradition govern not only lighting Shabbat candles in the home, or studying Torah, or putting on tefillin in a Beit Midrash, or a shul. Religion also informs our conduct in the less obvious manifestations of religious belief, from feeding the hungry, to assessing medical ethics, and to a million and one things in between. Education for Jews is not a purely secular endeavor, and certainly healing people is not a purely secular endeavor. So, in refusing to extend religious liberty beyond the parameters of what the administration chose to deem religious conduct, the administration denied people of faith the ability to define what aspects of their lives are guided by religion, which means that not only was this a threat to religious liberty in the narrow sense, in requiring individuals and organizations to violate their religious tenets, but also the administration impeded religious liberty by unilaterally redefining what it means to be religious. Or to bring it back to our discussion, this is, as it were, an attempt to wall up the chuppah, to force Americans to amputate faith from identity, to relegate religious belief in many respects to the private domain. And that is why that administration spoke often of freedom of worship, but very rarely free exercise of religion. But the chuppah is more than a symbol of celebration. It is taken to tell us something about the very nature of faith itself, and it represents an understanding of faith that is essential for the interfaith endeavor and ensuring of religious freedom, an idea, one which lies at the heart of the American idea. Rush himself understood this. Several months after attending the Jewish wedding, Benjamin Rush participated in the celebration of another union, one which we also discussed, a parade in honor of the American Constitution that had just been ratified by Pennsylvania. And Rush noted that the parade featured a spectacle that was impossible in the Europe of his day. Quote, the clergy of different Christian denominations with the rabbi of the Jews walking arm in arm. Benjamin Rush reflected that this was, quote, a most delightful sight. There could not have been a more happy emblem contrived of that section of the new Constitution which opens its powers and offices alike, not only to every sect of Christians, but to worthy men of every religion, end quote. And this, of course, is the America for which Jonas Phillips fought. It's therefore so fitting that an American founding father, signer of the Declaration of Independence, reflects the newfound freedom of Jews in America by attending the wedding of a Jewish family. But it is all the more fitting that the wedding that he attends is in the home of Jonas Phillips, the first religious liberty activist in this new nation, whose own life is a chuppah, which reminds us that our faith is an essential aspect of who we are, and that therefore it remains with us when we enter the legislature or when we are subpoenaed to testify in court, and that true religious liberty demands that society reflects this fact. That is the second interpretation of the chuppah, the concept of faith as being something that you bring with you from the home to the outside world, something which Jonas Phillips and Rush understood, but which so many today do not. That brings us to our final interpretation, because Rush was not only witnessing a chuppah in the home of Jonas Phillips. Unbeknownst to him at the time, he was seeing the formation of another link in a Jewish family, which would end up saving the home of one of his best friends, and thereby help perpetuate the legacy of the declaration that Benjamin Rush himself had signed. Because we know now that of the many children, not as many as their parents, unlike Jonas Phillips, who had 21 children, Rachel Phillips decided that was too many car seats, and they had only around 10 children. And one of those children was a remarkable boy by the name of, this is the bride whose wedding Rush attended, one of her children, was a remarkable boy by the name of Uriah Phillips Levy, who ran away to sea as a child, a 10 or 11-year-old child, promising that he would sail away and return home for his bar mitzvah. Childhood was very different in those days. John Quincy Adams is being sent to Russia. Uriah Phillips said, my kids never say to me, you know what? I'm heading out. I'll see you back for my bar mitzvah. That would be awesome. No. Okay. So he did return to mark his bar mitzvah and then set sail again. Most of his life was devoted to the American Navy, in which he served with great distinction, in which he led an ultimately successful campaign against flogging, against the lash in the Navy. Though he faced anti-Semitism and courts martial, I think he went through 5 or 6 courts martial in his career, defeating every single one, Uriah's legacy is honored by the armed forces today. And the Jewish chapel at the Navy Academy in Annapolis bears his name. If you've ever seen it, it's a magnificent, very beautiful structure. Uriah's hero was Thomas Jefferson because, as we mentioned this morning, of his dedication to religious liberty. Or as he put it, quote, I consider Thomas Jefferson to be one of the greatest men in history, author of the Declaration of Independence and an absolute Democrat. Why? Because, he said, he has served as an inspiration to millions of Americans. He did much to mold our republic in a form in which a man's religion does not make him ineligible for political or government life. That is why he was his hero. And so first, to honor Thomas Jefferson, he commissioned a statue of Jefferson, a bronze statue in France, which he brought to America, gave it to Congress, and it actually stands in the rotunda today. It is the only statue in the rotunda that comes from an independent donation. Every other statue was created by Congress itself. So that's who he is. Now in 1834, Uriah unites his own legacy with that of the man he most admired, because Thomas Jefferson, dying July 4th, 1826, leaves his estate bankrupt. Unlike George Washington, he cannot afford to free his slaves, and his estate is sold off for parts. Everything is assembled, auctioned off. Slaves are torn away from their wives and their husbands and sold away, and the estate lies in ruins. In 1834, Uriah, who had made some real estate investments and made a lot of money, he's listed in the 1850s as being one of the richest men in New York, purchases the estate in 1834 and devotes himself to Monticello's rehabilitation, not only making it look beautiful again, but going and buying back every object that he could get his hands on so that a huge majority of what is in Monticello today originally belonged to Thomas Jefferson, thanks to Uriah Phillips Levy. Uriah made Monticello the permanent home of his mother, Rachel. And when in 1839 Rachel Phillips Levy passed away, Uriah buried his mother there, interring his own flesh and blood in the same soil in which his hero had been buried 50 years after the birth of America. So that today, closer to Jefferson's home than his own grave, there is a Jewish kever which says, to the memory of Rachel Phillips Levy, died 7th of Iyar, 5591. That is what the Jewish grave in Monticello says. Thus did the young woman, whose wedding was attended by a man who signed the Declaration of Independence, come to rest eternally in the home of the man who had authored the Declaration of Independence. Uriah died in 1862 at the height of the Civil War. Monticello fell into Confederate hands, ultimately being returned to an heir of Uriah, the aptly named Jefferson Levy, a congressman from New York. That's actually his name. Jefferson Halevi Levy, the nephew of Uriah Phillips Levy. Congressman Levy restored Monticello once again, and ultimately, this is a long and protracted tale, but ultimately gave or transferred the estate to the American people in the 1920s to serve as a testament to Jefferson's legacy. And so it was in Monticello that a Jewish family saved and preserved the legacy of the author of the Declaration. It was there that this Jew, born of this couple whose wedding Benjamin Rush witnessed, that he interred his mother, that bride, burying the bride whose wedding Benjamin Rush attended. Rush himself, a man of immense curiosity and openness of mind, and yet who could never, when he was at that wedding, could never in his wildest imagination have conceived that this bride that he was admiring under this canopy would find her eventual eternal resting place in the estate of Thomas Jefferson, one of the pillars of the Revolution and President of the United States. But I believe that Rush, while surprised, would not have been bothered by it, and indeed would have celebrated it. Because just as he celebrated the rabbi walking arm in arm with the minister in celebration of the Constitution, he would have taken the story of the family whose wedding he witnessed as another indication of the extraordinary openness and diversity of the American story. And here another final interpretation of the chuppah can be introduced, and a deeper connection between the canopy and America can thereby be found. This is a wonderful interpretation of the chuppah, which I believe is even better, perhaps, than the Abraham and Sarah interpretation, but which never, strangely, makes its way onto the wedding pamphlet handouts. My father referred me to Marsha, the classic commentator in the back of the Talmud, who argues that the chuppah, the canopy, is reminiscent of the Mishkan, the tabernacle tent in the desert. In his explanation, Marsha cites the blessing under the chuppah, said to bride and groom, Baruch Atah Hashem, blessed are you God, Mikadesh Amo Yisrael, what's the phrase? Al Yidei Chuppah V'Kiddushin, which is usually translated as, blessed are you, O God, who sanctifies Israel by giving them the commandments of Chuppah and Kiddushin, the sanctification of marriage. But Marsha brilliantly suggests that in fact, it means as follows. God himself was Mikadesh Amo Yisrael al Yidei Chuppah V'Kiddushin. God himself sanctified and married us through a canopy and through marriage. Meaning that God married the Jewish people through what? A chuppah, which is the tabernacle, the home that God and the Jewish people designed and built together. And that means, therefore, we say at a wedding, blessed are you, O God, Mekadesh Amo Yisrael al Yidei Chuppah V'Kiddushin, who himself married the people of Israel through a chuppah, through a canopy that parallels this one, the canopy, of course, being the tabernacle, the Mishkan in the desert. The tabernacle, then, was Israel's chuppah with God. It was with the creation of the Mishkan, rather than Sinai, that our covenantal destiny was fully forged. And the lesson here is not only religious, but social. Because if the chuppah represents a tabernacle, then it is the tabernacle that teaches us about covenant and about an idea which dramatically impacted America. How covenant can allow us to form a unity without doing away with differences. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks tells a story about how he used to meet Prime Minister Tony Blair for Bible sessions. They would study the Bible together. This was kept secret because Prime Minister of England is not allowed to talk about being religious. His spokesman Alistair Campbell said, "We don't do God," that's what he said. So once in the secret Bible session, Blair says to Sacks, "Jonathan, I've reached the boring part of the Bible." So Rabbi Sacks says, Well, which boring part of the Bible have you reached, Prime Minister? So he says, the tabernacle does go on a bit, doesn't it? By the way, my English accent is terrible. Indeed it does. The book of Exodus describes in intricate detail, 600 verses, the creation, the different Israelite tribes contributing whatever they had, material and creative skills, to make this tabernacle. The creation of the universe by God, 34 verses. So, as Ezra Sachs put it, creation of the universe, 34 verses. Creation of one shul in the desert, 600 verses, because shuls are built by committees. So, it takes forever. Okay. So why the apparently excessive elaboration as to the tabernacle? The lesson, Rabbi Sachs says, is not only theological but political. And that is why the building of the tabernacle appears not in the cultic book of the Bible, Leviticus, but rather the political book of the Bible, Exodus. Because it is through building the tabernacle that Israel emerges as a covenant nation. As he puts it, to turn a group of individuals or diverse tribes into a nation, they must build something together. The tabernacle was built out of difference, each a distinctive contribution. Some brought metals, other jewels, other their skills and time. How do you turn a group of people into a nation? God's answer was dazzling in its simplicity. You get them voluntarily to create something together. A nation is built by building. The tabernacle represents what Rabbi Sachs calls integration without assimilation. Because we are not the same, we each have something unique to contribute, something only we can give. Society for the Bible is, in Rabbi Sachs' words, the home we build together. And the tabernacle story is meant to teach us that we need not deny our differences to covenant as one nation. Similarly, in standing under the chuppah, a bride and groom who are very different people remember the tabernacle and commit themselves to devote their respective talents to becoming one family, to building a home together, a home for each other and for God. Integration without assimilation. It was just such a home that Benjamin Rush witnessed this Jewish bride and groom beginning to build. But as we now know, this was not the only home that this family helped build. So it's fitting then that Jonas Phillips' family saved Jefferson's home and gave that home to America, because that truly, better than anything else, is the best embodiment of America as the home we can build together. And the unabashedly Jewish headstone on Monticello's estate represents the integration without assimilation for which Jonas Phillips fought. The chuppah embodies integration without assimilation for a couple covenanting together. And America, as we have said, was founded on the notion of integration without assimilation, of a nation indivisible through covenant, but without one's religious identity subsumed into one another. Michael McConnell, the scholar of religion, has noted that applying the American idea of equality to religion is different than applying it to race. As he puts it, human equality means that for America, differences based on race are irrelevant. The ideal of free exercise and must be overcome. The ideal of free exercise of religion, by contrast, is that people of different religious convictions are different and that those differences are precious and must not be disturbed. So the Phillips family plot in the home of the author of the Declaration and of Virginia's Statute of Religious Freedom is an eternal testament of the ability of America to be a home we build together, of American faith to come together, to preserve our differences while being welcomed for our unique contribution that we can make to this country. An eternal reminder to Jews in America to make Jonas Phillips' principles our own. Looking back then, we understand how the chuppah witnessed by Rush is such a fascinating embodiment of the American Jewish ability to be different and yet welcomed in our unique contribution that we can make to this country, a social home we can build together. How the couple that Rush witnessed in their humble chuppah ended up bequeathing America the home of the author of the Declaration, who had himself suggested, as we have seen, that the seal of the United States be an image of traveling tribes in the desert, which we know that they traveled surrounding the tabernacle, integrated but not assimilated, and guided by God. Now, the Israelites were all of one faith, of course, but this image inspired the founders because for them it was a model for what society can achieve when it sees itself as both contractual and covenantal, made up of members unique, but also covenantally united. But it is also a challenge to Jews today, when more than ever before we are welcomed, not despite our differences, but because of them. It challenges us to make our unique contribution to America. This was brought home to me when I had the privilege of attending the White House Hanukkah party. It's extraordinary. The Marine Band is resplendent in red outfits. They're playing Chanukah, Chanukah, Yontav, Ashena. And at one point, and there was sushi, which is very important. And at one point, somebody comes over and says, you know, we're going to form a minyan for Ma'ariv. Can you join us? And I was initially taken aback. But it was too good an opportunity to pass up. And so with a resounding Baruch Hu et Hashem Hamforach, we created an establishment of religion in the center of the free world. And I felt that at that moment, this White House, this country, was a home that we were asked to build together with our fellow Americans. And in such an America, the questions facing us are, if we are able to remain loyal to what makes us different and yet contribute to a joint destiny, what does divine providence desire us to accomplish? In an America whose origins were so impacted by Jewish ideas, what uniquely Jewish ideas ought to be communicated to this country today? When future generations ponder the freedom that allowed Jews to flourish in this land, will they reflect with pride on the fact that we utilize this freedom to live up to our own covenantal calling as Jews, established with Abraham when he was informed by the Almighty that his children would change the world? These questions are asked all too rarely. But asking and attempting to answer them is our obligation, and hopefully the story of Rush and of seeing the home that this couple built together and of whose family bequeathed Monticello as the ultimate symbol of the home we built together, hopefully understanding this and thereby the Jewish meaning of America, will inspire all of us to ask and to answer these questions. Several months ago, I journeyed with members of my congregation and others and students from Yeshiva University to Monticello. I stood in the room where Jefferson died, and then we visited the Jewish grave that was there. We stood at the gravesite of Rachel Phillips Levy, of the bride whose wedding Benjamin Rush had attended, whose family saved Monticello. And thinking about my hero, Jonas Phillips, who sought to be both stranger and neighbor, ger and toshav, I could not help but think of the context in which Abraham first invokes that phrase. Ger v'toshav anochi imachem, kechuli achuzat, tenuli achuzat kever imachem. I am a stranger and a neighbor among you. Give me my own covenantal burial plot. There is no better symbol of the fulfillment of Jonas Phillips' dream of America as a place to be both stranger and neighbor than visiting the grave at that very moment. While there, we performed several rituals. As Jews do when they visit a grave, we took stones and placed it on the grave of Rachel Phillips Levy. We said the memorial prayer for the soul. This is the Sephardic memorial prayer, the Hashkavah. It's like the Ashkenazic Kel Malei Rachamim, for the soul of Uriah Phillips Levy and other members of the Levy family, and of course, for the woman buried there, and ultimately for Jonas Phillips. And then I recited the Kaddish on their behalf. And as I stood there, I reflected on the fact that actually it was three American founders, Franklin, Adams, and Jefferson, who each at various points in their own lives thought of their deaths and composed epigraphs to be placed near their graves following their passing. And each in its own way respectively reflects some aspect of the Jewish method of memory and ritual at a grave. As a young man of 22, Franklin whimsically penned the following for his gravestone. This is not actually on his gravestone, but this is what he wrote. The body of B. Franklin, printer, like the cover of an old book, its contents torn out and stripped of its lettering and gilding, lies here, food for worms. But the work shall not be wholly lost, for it will, as he believed, appear once more in a new and more perfect edition, corrected and amended by the author. In other words, Franklin at age 22, in perhaps a more religious sentiment that he showed in much of his life, is suggesting that immortality is to be found in the afterlife, in the immortality of the soul and resurrection. And of course, Jews devoutly believe in this concept, and it was reflected in the memorial prayer that we recited at that grave. Meanwhile, John Adams, at the end of his life, in perhaps the most Jewish act that a founding father ever did in preparing for death, placed several stones throughout his family graveyard and wrote on one of them the following. Near the tomb of his ancestor. He wrote, "This stone and several others have been placed in this yard by a great-great-grandson from a veneration of the piety, humility, simplicity, prudence, frugality, industry, and perseverance of his ancestors in hopes of recommending an affirmation of their virtues to their posterity. As David McCullough puts it, Adams had chosen to say nothing of any of his own attainments, but rather to place himself as part of a continuum and to evoke those qualities of character that he had been raised on and that he had strived for so long to uphold. And that, of course, is why Jews put stones on a cemetery, seeing ourselves as part of a continuum and saying that we will build on the accomplishments of those who came before. And so when we place stones on that grave, I thought of our obligations, not just my obligation, but all of your obligations, all of our obligations as Jews living in America, to build on the legacy of the Phillips family, to build on what they helped found. And then there is Thomas Jefferson, whose own grave was not that far from where we stood, and whose obelisk, which he himself composed, boldly reads the following. Here was buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence, of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia. Jefferson, who did not mention on his grave that he was the third president of the United States, is emphasizing that we live on not in the power we wield, but rather in how we have educated and inspired others, and how we have changed the world. This too Jews believe, and it lies at the heart of the prayer that I recited in memory of Jonas Phillips at that grave. Because the Kaddish is often called a prayer for the dead, but its text does not mention the dead. Rather, what we are saying is that we are so inspired by those who came before that we dedicate ourselves to following their example and sanctifying the name of God, and that thereby their own story continues through us. And so I recited in one of the most memorable and moving rituals of my life, Kaddish at the grave of Rachel Phillips Levy, for my own hero, Jonas Phillips, expressing how inspired I was by his example. And I concluded by speaking to all those assembled about July 4th, 1826, when John Adams, dying in Quincy, Massachusetts, uttered the words, "Thomas Jefferson survives." At that moment, David McCullough writes, all those present would remember ever after that there was a final clap of thunder that shook the house, the rain stopped, and the last sun of day broke through dark, low-hanging clouds with a sky beautiful and grand beyond description. It's a lovely story, but of course what Adams did not know when he said the words, "Thomas Jefferson survives," is that Jefferson had died in Monticello just several hours before. But of course, that doesn't mean that what Adams said was untrue. In the story of the death of King David, when he is lying dying on his deathbed, his wife Bathsheba comes and says that you are about to die, please appoint Solomon as your heir. David agrees, and Bathsheba replies, may King David live forever. Having just predicted his death, she now says he's going to live forever. But the point, of course, as the commentator Malbim writes, is that she is expressing that now through his heir, who has his principles and his virtues, David's life and all that he lived for will live on, and therefore he will never die. In this sense, of course, what Adam said was true. Thomas Jefferson survives. The Declaration's relevance never died. The American experiment endures. And in a similar sense, everyone knows of Thomas Jefferson. Everyone knows of the Declaration. But few know of the people of whom you have learned this week. But the truth is, the Phillips family also survives. And their immortality is forever bound up as well with Monticello's legacy and all that it embodies. Of course, that refers to Congressman Jefferson Levy, who transferred the landmark to the American people, to Commodore Uriah Philip Levy's service to his country, to Jonas Phillips' other grandson, Mordecai Emanuel Noah, who stood for Judaism in America while becoming part of American public life. It refers to the beautiful bride whose chuppah was attended by Benjamin Rush in the ultimate illustration of the fact that an American Jewish family could be open to the public and yet dedicated to what makes it different. But of course, the one who lives on most of all is the family patriarch Jonas Phillips, father of the woman who was buried there, patriot who served in the Revolutionary War, a religious liberty activist, and a man who was always an observer of God's Torah and keeper of his commandments, thereby teaching us forever that the freedom afforded by America and the equality expressed in Jefferson's Declaration obligates us to live as steadfast Jews and dedicated Americans. I will never forget standing at that grave and saying the Kaddish in perpetuation of Jefferson Levy, Commodore Uriah Phillips Levy, Mordecai Emanuel Noah, Rachel Phillips Levy, Rebecca Machado Phillips, mother of 21 children, and all the Jewish patriots who we've discussed and who remain steadfast in their faith as they helped found and build a new country. Indeed, Thomas Jefferson survives, but Jonas Phillips lives on as well. May his memory be a blessing, and may he live on in the hearts and minds of American Jews for generations to come. Thank you very much.
Brother Soloveitchik, having now just seen this incredible final lecture in our series, what do you want Americans who are Jewish and Americans who are not Jewish to take away from this incredible symbol of the chuppah?
The chuppah is, on the one hand, one of the most powerful symbols in Judaism, as it brings together love, covenantal continuity, marriage, the endurance of the Jewish people. And yet at the same time, what we call the chuppah today, the canopy, is actually quite new as far as Jewish history is concerned. It develops a couple centuries ago, maybe five, six, seven centuries ago. So you have this famous symbol of Judaism that actually emerges out of Jewish history. And what I'm saying in this lecture is that when you look at the diversity of interpretations that have been given for the chuppah, so many of them speak to the Jewish ideas that ended up impacting America, and therefore add a poetic, sublime aspect to a signer of the Declaration being at a Jewish chuppah and being at the chuppah of a family that would ultimately go on to preserve the legacy of the man who authored the Declaration. The themes that we stressed in the lecture regarding the chuppah are primarily three. First, we suggested that the chuppah is itself a democratization of royalty, that you have Jews who take the coronation canopy from kings and queens and popes, and instead of giving it to their nobility, they bestow it on every Jewish husband and wife, thereby saying, in one of the most beautiful verses in the Bible regarding the coronation of the original Jewish royalty, David, Adam yireh la'einayim v'Hashem yireh la'levav. Man looks to the superficial, but God looks to the heart. And yes, Judaism also has a royalty, and it has a royal family, and it has a kingly dynasty. But true royalty is character in our desire and willingness to live for others and for God. And so Jews are saying in the chuppah that you, husband and wife, who are now throwing self-interestedness at least partially away and dedicating yourself to live for another and to perpetuate the story of the Jewish people, you are truly royal. And you are, in a sense, more royal than all those kings and queens that the Europeans are honoring. This idea is being marked by Jews long before Thomas Paine gave it to the American colonists. And so there's this fittingness to a signer of the Declaration experiencing this chuppah. Rush, who had himself, as we mentioned before, undergone his own transformation regarding monarchy. So that's the first theme. The second theme is a notion of religion which is unfortunately being lost today. And that is the chuppah as an embodiment of the tent of Abraham and Sarah, which famously was open on four sides, symbolizing their desire to be both ger and toshav, neighbor and stranger, open to the world, serving even three apparent pagans who show up at Abraham's door, but also the monotheistic messengers to the world, bringing his religious mission with him wherever he goes, thereby teaching us that you cannot amputate your religious identity from yourself when you leave your home and enter the public square. And that is a notion that was at the heart of the original American conception of religious liberty that is being lost today. And therefore, it's so fitting, again, that Rush was at the chuppah because it embodies the very essence of the openness that Jews, as Jews, found in the American public square. And finally, the chuppah as the tabernacle in the desert, which, as Rabbi Sacks movingly argues, is the first moment post-Sinai where Israel truly is united as a people because they are allowing for difference within unity. And that teaches us that covenant itself, it allows for what Ressacks calls integration without assimilation. And that, as he himself wistfully notes, as a British member of the House of Lords, is something that America has achieved in a way that other countries in Europe have not achieved. And so not only is it fitting that Rush, as this patriotic American, is seeing this chuppah, but you have a chuppah taking place, witnessed by a founding father, that is forming a family that will produce a child that will help keep Jefferson's home intact. So if the chuppah is a tabernacle, if the chuppah is the symbol of society as the home we build together, can there be any better symbol of society as a home we build together than of Jefferson's home being saved by the Phillips family? To me, you couldn't come up with a better ending to this saga.